Call a meeting of the Higher Education Finance Committee to order. We do have a quorum. I'd like to begin, I think, by having someone make a motion to approve the minutes from Wednesday, March the 29th. Senator Mariani moves that we approve the minutes from Wednesday, March 29th. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Approved. All right. First bill up today, House File 3136. Representative Abrams, good morning.
Good morning.
Good afternoon, I guess. I'm sorry.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 3136 be recommended to pass and considered for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Education Finance Bill. And I have a couple of minor technical amendments. On page 1, line 22, after Minnesota, insert, and Chancellor of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. R, private data, R rather than is. And then on page 2, line 6, after the first or chancellor of. And that's to bring Vinsky back in, because Chancellor Vinsky back in, because I've heard over the transom that some people associated with Vinsky may be interested in it. So I'd like to move that as an amendment and then discuss the bill, understanding that the underlying bill has some degree of controversy.
Okay, you want to move the oral amendment?
I'm going to move that amendment.
Any questions for members? All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman and members, House File 3136 is a legislative response to the decision by the State Supreme Court that the process for choosing the president of the University of Minnesota is not exempt either from the open meeting law or data practices. Our purpose in bringing the bill forward is not to criticize in any way the decision by the State Supreme Court, but rather to state that there is probably a better public policy and other considerations that ought to go forward. I have with me today Regent Frank Berman, and first let me state that neither the Board of Regents nor the administration of the University of Minnesota has an official position on House File 3136, but various members of the Board of Regents, at least in their individual capacity, support it. Under the current system, the selection of the finalist, the interview with the finalist, and the final deliberations of the Board of Regents would all be public. And in talking to people who have gone through the process, they think that that leads to a less qualified and weaker candidate at the end, rather than a stronger candidate to run a multi-billion dollar institution. To those who would say that the university changed the process in selecting President Brunings as president, we can go back and take a look at the process under which Mark Udall was selected as president of the University of Minnesota. At that time, he had just been passed over for the position of chancellor of the University of Texas System. So he was definitely on the market and was not shy about making his intentions known that he was going to leave the University of Texas. The other two finalists, I had forgotten until recently, when their names became public, pulled out, so that there was only one candidate that went forward in the final selection process for president of the University of Minnesota when Mark Udall was selected, And in fact, former Governor Carlson said that the process should be started over again. I'd also point out that when President Udoff left the University of Minnesota, he had been courted in private by the University of Texas for 4 to 6 months and was presented as the only candidate for that position. So the University of Texas would operate under the same rules and conditions that the University of Minnesota currently does. If you want to go back further, and it is always difficult to say negative things or even imply negative things about those who are still contributing members of the University of Minnesota faculty, to the two previous presidents of the University of Minnesota who went through the process were Ken Keller and Niels Hassemo. And I would suspect that there are large segments of the academic and other community that necessarily view their presidencies of the University of Minnesota as being highly successful. The idea behind House File 3136 is not to say that this is the only process. By going back to the presumption that the data is not public and that the there would be no open meeting law applied, is the only process by which a president of the university could be selected. It is to say that that is a better idea than what current law, as it currently stands in Minnesota, is, and that I'm certainly open to other ideas to improve the process to get the strongest possible candidate for that important position, as well as for Chancellor of the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. So with that, I'd like to ask my witness, Regent Frank Berman, to testify. And if I am your attorney, Mr. Berman, I would point out that if there's any jail time to be served, it'll be you, not me.
I brought my handcuffs along.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frank Berman, I'm a member of the Board of Regents. Good afternoon, and first I must apologize. I got tied up in other meetings, and I had some meetings scheduled with two members of the committee and did not make those meetings. I apologize and would like to see you at some other convenient time.
Representative, can you move the microphone over just a minute?
Sure. I would encourage questions because I was part of the 2003 presidential search, and from that I concluded that this is the most serious non-financial issue that I've encountered in my 5 years on the Board of Regents. And I believe that sound public policy demands a change in the process. Per the open meeting law, the Democrats Act requires that all university presidential candidates that the board chooses to interview must be made public. The interviews must be done in public, and all deliberations must be done in public. The position of the university president is that of a business executive who manages a $2 billion a year budget, who must attract and maintain excellent faculty in the number of thousands of persons, and must oversee the educational, faculty, and student performance and the public service of the university. I would suggest to you that it is surely the most important job the Board of Regents has to do, that is to choose its president, and it requires a range of skills that's enormous, and I believe that there's no other public position in the state that demands more skills than that of the university president. Higher education is now highly competitive, and far more so, I suspect, than when the open meeting law was first adopted. The university must compete with all private institutions and with most public institutions for their presidents. The open meeting law can destroy the university's ability to find the best possible person for that credible position to the university as well as to the state. And that proved to be the case in 2003, and fortunately we had President Bruins available just before he retired. But we can't always assume that we'll be so fortunate. We hired Korn Ferry, the preeminent search firm, and they immediately told us that under the open meeting law, that will prevent anyone of stature from applying because it harms their current position, it will adversely affect their own career, this open meeting process, and no one of stature will take the position without first having a private interview with a board they'll report to, which is prohibited by the open meeting law. Corn Ferry suggested that we would get long-time provosts who had not advanced and would have little to lose, small institution presidents who may well not yet be ready for the job, and internal people would be the limit of the pool. And that indeed happened, and following the case that we had, we were required to disclose publicly that two long-term provosts had been finalists, as well as one president of a small institution. No one, frankly, of real stature, the one that the university deserves, and the open meeting law eliminates applicants out of stature. Worse yet, elimination of the pool of applicants that is available for that most important position is that the deliberations of the board must also be in public. You must discuss the detriments of each of the candidates in public. And frankly, no one of stature would participate in such a spectacle, and it frankly is demeaning to the board to have to do so. They probably couldn't do it in an effective way. Moreover, you have to vote in public, and no one will submit to the risk of a very embarrassing vote of any stature. So the process was completely frustrated in 2003 by the open meeting law, and the board unanimously resolved to close the process because it obstructed the search for the best candidates, and we could not discharge our fiduciary duty, in my view, to the legislature and the state. And I supplied copies to you of that resolution, have more copies available. Without the open meeting law, there's other experience. The university will get the best possible person for the job. For example, Michigan, unimpeded by an open meeting law, hired recently the University of Iowa, a person of stature. As Representative Abrams indicated, no open meeting law in Texas. They courted Mark Udoff privately for several months, and frankly, he was essentially hired before we were even aware of what was happening. That's the sort of competition that we face. The university, members, has a record of openness. All board meetings and virtually all committee meetings are completely open. There are some issues that we could be closed on under the statute. For example, labor negotiations and strategy, personnel evaluations, other issues that the statute permits. Even those where we're permitted openness, the university has uniformly adopted a position of openness on virtually every single issue. You have a record of complete openness to the university, but this is the one exception to the open meeting law that the university, I believe, desperately needs. And moreover, it is not an entirely private process. Once the putative president is selected, even under the present process, what happens is there's a vetting period of 2 weeks or so. That putative president that we want to hire meets with all the faculty publicly, meets with all the students publicly, meets with the press publicly, and meets with all the groups of interest. And there is a vetting process before that person is actually hired, and that person knows that once they're hired, it's a public university that's thoroughly committed to openness. But it is very necessary and very narrow exception that I believe will serve the university well and suggest what the public what public policy really is all about. I might point out that I have tried to speak with the members of the press on the issue. Minnesota Daily called me. I gave them a complete interview on the issue, provided them with a copy of the memo that I provided to you folks. I asked to speak to the editorial staff of the Minnesota Daily and asked if they would call me to make an appointment at their convenience. I got no call back. They don't want to even listen to reason. In the Tribune, Mr. Draper wrote an article. I had testified before the Civil Law Committee 2 days earlier. He never called for a quote. All they do is quote other executives of press groups. I will say this. The only person who incidentally told me this was bedrock and I'm not going to change anybody's mind was Laurie Sturdivant, who did grant me an interview, and I appreciate that very much of her. But that's the fact. That's been the attitude. Don't listen to reason. But the reason is that public policy requires this very narrow exception, and frankly, it will best serve the state to have it. Thank you for hearing that, Mr. Chair, and I'd certainly entertain any questions and be thrilled to answer them.
Thank you, Regent Dugan. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Berman, you referred to other institutions that have different regulations in place. Do you have any idea, I mean, what other people are doing? What are people doing in the Big Ten, for example?
Well, first of all the private institutions do not have an open meeting law to concern themselves with. As to the Big Ten, there is a split. Michigan does not have an open meeting law. Wisconsin does. But Ohio State, I do not believe, has an open meeting law, as I recall. I'm not sure I recall that right, but I think I do. But there's also gradations of open meeting laws. For example, some open meeting laws do not require that the interviews be conducted in public. Some open meeting laws do not require that the deliberations be in public. Some open meeting laws may require that there be a vetting process afterwards, which would immensely improve the process. So there's gradations. This open meeting law is very restrictive that we have because it says anybody that you decide to interview is a finalist and you've got to disclose everything about him. So that, him or her, so that in itself winds up being a counterproductive process. So you can have gradations of open meeting laws where there's a balancing. This law has virtually no balancing. Anyone who's going to be interviewed has to be disclosed fully and deliberated about and interviewed fully in public. Representative Cox.
Just a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you elect not to interview someone, then that information can be kept private?
Then there remain an applicant who's not a finalist, and that would remain private. It's the finalist. It's really the finalist who lose out, who you're trying to protect.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, Regent Berman, I heard Representative Abrams say that there was a position of the regents on this. So can you tell me, is there a public position on
this? No, not at all. I think you said the opposite, but let me make that clear. The regents have not adopted an official position on this issue.
Mr. Chair, Regent, are they afraid to vote publicly and have it recorded?
May I? I'll be happy to tell you what I understand the reason to be.
I wish you would.
All right. The reason is this. The administration has a program at the legislature. The regents were first of all concerned that they taking an official position on this issue would undermine that program. That was number one. Number two, regents, frankly, we don't hire lobbyists. We are not accustomed to such a thing, but the fact of the matter is that the regents do not have an official position on this issue. I am strictly expressing my personal views based upon my experience over the last 5 years, and I'm not going to speak for other regents. I think the representative Abrams told you that he had talked to a number of other regents who indicated a like position, but I am speaking for my position at this hearing.
Well, Mr. Chair, Regent Berman, this is a little perplexing that we have a group, a public group, an entity that comes to the legislature that we select that won't take a position on whether or not we should not have public hearings on one of the most visible higher education leaders, if not the most visible higher education leader in the state. And you just told me, you don't hire lobbyists? Does the region, do you authorize the expenditures at the university?
Authorize the expenditure of certainly our government relations department. But let me answer the question more fully.
Well, Mr. Chair, Regent Berman, isn't that a lobbyist?
May I answer the question more fully, Mr. Senator? The last time the regents have spoken the issue was during the course of the 2003 search. There was a unanimous resolution closing the search because the regents were frustrated and simply couldn't discharge their fiduciary duty with an openness that this statute requires. The last time they spoke publicly and by resolution and unanimously was at the time of the 2003 search. So that would be the last precedent that you would have on an official regents position.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Pulaski.
And Regent Berman, and that position was that there should be closed,
yes.
No public, and we have that vote.
You have that vote. That's a unanimous vote in 2000.
And on the legislation that's before us, we do not have a vote.
That's correct.
And the reason for not voting is because they have, how did you express it?
Mr. Berman.
I hope I can do it again. The regents have not expressed an official position because there was concern that the regents' position would detract from the program that the university administration, the university has before the legislature on various issues. That was the reason as I understood it.
Mr. Chair, Regent Berman, that's disconcerting that they would not take a position on a policy as large as this because they thought it might negatively impact either the stadium, the bonding proposal, or the bioscience separate, I'd like to call it the third bonding proposal. So because it might negatively impact one or all three, they're not going to take a position publicly.
It may be disconcerting to you, Representative Pawlowski, but the fact of the matter is there was a position taken in 2003 on this very issue, and that, as I understand it, was the reason.
Well, Mr. Chair, Regent Berman, the bill before us is a little bit different than what happened in 2003. This is the bill that's before us today, not the one that's from 2003. It seems that there's a real problem with openness at the U. If it isn't openness on whether or not we're selecting the president, it's openness on whether or not they're going to take a position on how they should select the president.
There's no problem with openness at the university. I can tell you that that is the most honest and open board that I have ever had exposure to. They are open on everything, literally everything except attorney-client privileged issues under the prior rate case. They are open on those things that this legislature has said they could be closed on. As a matter of fact, the legislature itself has recognized that on personnel issues, labor negotiations, evaluating personnel, things like that, those can be closed. What the legislature has omitted, and I think improperly so, is protecting applicants who are not yet employed by the university, who need just as much protection, I suggest. So the principle of protecting personnel-related issues is in the statute already. This is a very narrow addition to that, to what is already in your statute and is exempted from the open meeting law, and the state has said need not be open.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, my interpretation of what you just said would be this: you're open on everything except for two issues, this bill and then the process of selecting the president.
No, I think we're open on virtually every issue that we have, and we were closed on the position of the president because we were frustrated in 2003 in being able to pick one, and that's the issue that's presented to you now.
Well, Chair Regent Berman, I share your frustration.
Representative Rodell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regent Berman, let's continue a little bit with Representative Pawlowski's comments. The Board of Regents may be very open, and I don't question if they are, but I do question the openness on some other decisions that have been made at the university, and not just the one that we also discussed earlier this morning. I could maybe talk in more detail with you about that some other time, but I do think that there are some openness problems at the university. Mr. Chairman Regent, I would like to just ask this question. What would your position be on closing the process until the final recommendation of one candidate for president is made?
Well, let me speak to that. After the board picks the putative candidate that they plan to appoint as president, I believe that the process now by custom and practice is open. There's a two-week period during which there's a vetting where all groups talk, question, investigate, and all the rest of it. That does not cause any difficulty. In fact, I think it's a very wholesome thing to be doing. So my personal position on that is that once the person is selected by the board as being the person they intend to hire, to have information public and to have a public identity of that person, I believe that that would not adversely affect the process. The process is adversely affected because the finalists who might lose do not want to be made public. It's adversely affected by having to have open deliberations rather than closed ones when you prior to come to that decision, and it's adversely affected by the pool that you get because of the threat of a public disclosure by the by the board of those who were not selected. So my position on that would be that it would immensely, the process would nonetheless be substantially improved.
Thank you.
Representative
Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have met with Regent Berman and some other people about this, and I'm convinced there's an issue here. I think that the remedy suggested is a bit broad. And I think that this is being held over today for inclusion or possible inclusion anyway, and so there's a little bit of time. But I would suggest, kind of on the lines of what Representative Erdahl was talking about, that maybe if the different people who have an interest in this thing could find a way to narrowly exempt themselves from the criteria that they need to be exempted from, and create even a separate little paragraph or small chapter in where the university law is held that would discuss presidential searches, that we could then, you know, when we mark up our bill, that'd be a good time to take that up, I would guess, in lieu of this particular piece that's before us, and I'm willing to help if the author wants any assistance on that to move along. But that would be, I think, that in my mind would give, because there is an issue, but I think to exempt the entire process is more than what they even want. And I think talking to the different people, there's not been an issue with openness that I sense, but there's an issue with this challenge, and so that's hopefully a way to move the discussion forward.
Representative Abelman?
Yeah, there's one other point I'd like to make, and I'm glad that my friend Representative Pawlowski is in the room. I am concerned about how this current system could possibly be gamed. If you are a member of the Board of Regents, and you have a pretty good idea who you want to have as president, that can be data private until you've decided who are the finalists and go through that interview process. You can basically have one strong candidate and the rest of the candidates be weak candidates who you have no intention of offering the position to under the current system, or under the system that has been found by the Supreme Court that must be used. And I don't necessarily think that that's the sort of result we would want either. Any system that you have can potentially be used in a malevolent sort of way. And what my concern is to try to put in place a better system than the one that under the decision by the Supreme Court is there. So, you know, I share some of your concerns, Representative Pawlowski. It's really a difficult issue. It's like trying to get through a sea of jello. But I do think that the time that you start thinking about these issues is when you have a good president in place who's healthy and is going to be there for a while, rather than wait until, gee, we have another search coming up, what are we going to do now? So that's the purpose of bringing the bill forward.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abrams, I appreciate you bringing this up for discussion, because really what it seems that we have is we have two really important competing interests. Mm-hmm. And I think Representative Abler is right that there may be some way to get to a midpoint. I'm very concerned that by closing things as tightly or restrict them as tightly as the bill before us would allow, we might miss some of the good things that our open process brings forward. I think that we recently saw some in the St. Paul school selection process, some really good things that kind of came out of their similar open process. I'm assuming probably some of the candidate information that came out was by way of the press, digging and poking and looking a little harder. And I think that depending on what every public body has resources and ability and time to do, will have some bearing on that. But I do understand. I think at first I was a hard sell on this, even though I didn't meet with you. That was going to be a hard sell. But I think that we can get to some kind of middle ground, hopefully, that works. And I appreciate the fact that you're right. The time to do this is when things are running well and you don't need to kick this in gear tomorrow. A selection process, I mean, not this bill.
So. Members, we have five bills we're hoping to get through today. So at this time, I'd like to ask for a couple of witnesses, I guess. Mark.
Athanson. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Pawlowski.
I don't have any of the bills in my packet, so I went to get one. Could you tell me what the amendment was that was offered to the bill?
President Chancellor Minsky, and Jean.
Okay.
Please come to the witness table and
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I have the someone with me because we both come up together.
I think so.
It's really combined.
Yeah, and if we can ask you to be as concise as you can, we'll begin with identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association, the Trade Association of all the state's newspapers.
I'm Britt Johnson, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Daily.
Britt will go first, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Johnson. Right. If you could move the microphone over, so we can pick it up. Okay, thank you.
I am speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Daily, the University of Minnesota student newspaper, and also as a student. I'm a senior at the University of Minnesota. I've been there for about 3 years. I've also been at the paper for 3 years. And as I've been there, I've seen how a president really affects the university and the climate there, the decisions made that really affect the students. So I guess I'll just get right into a couple points that I wanted to make. The first is just that secrecy is bad because we lose accountability. We don't know anything about the background of president candidates. We don't know anything about the diversity of the candidates, whether it's women, minorities that are applying for the job. And I think students deserve to know who will be leading the university, that and that person that will greatly affect everybody. Another point is just that students should know who this person is and sort of get to know what they want to do for the university. They should have that comfortability, trust, and confidence that making the process open would secure. So, also, secrecy doesn't necessarily help or guarantee anything. There have been other presidents at universities that maybe made good or bad decisions, and so I guess I just wanted to say that keeping it closed doesn't necessarily make the process any smoother, doesn't necessarily ensure a better candidate. And just generally, lastly, I want to say that students really deserve to know, and taxpayers, people in Minnesota ought to know who this candidate is and what they would do for this public institution. Thanks for hearing my viewpoints, and I'll take any questions if you have them.
Thank you very much. Maybe there'll be a question later. Please identify yourself, please.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Again, Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. I'll emphasize a couple of additional points and conclude quickly. This is a radical change in state law. This, contrary to what you've heard, is not something the Supreme Court foisted on the university a couple of years ago. This has basically been the law of the state for 30 years. It applies to all political subdivisions and public bodies in the state, not just the regents. 30 years ago, the legislature struck what is a very sensible balance here. What they said was this: the initial slate of applicants will not be public. So in the case of the university, you get a couple hundred applicants. Most of those names never, ever become public. The last three or four, the finalists, do become public. That strikes the balance. That has been the balance you set repeatedly over the years. It's a balance that should be preserved because it reasonably takes into account both the privacy and the public accountability arguments. We hear over and over that the best candidates will not apply if they have to fear being publicly described as finishing second or third place. I hope you understand how little evidence there is for that point of view. It's not just me. It's not just the Daily. This is an issue that has been vexing the entire country for 20 years. There are public universities in almost every state. Most states do not permit this kind of secrecy, and for good reason, because you lose any chance to scrutinize the process of selecting, as Regent Berman said, arguably the public official that requires more skills than any other in the state. Let me give you one quick example of how misleading this idea of losing the best candidates is. The presidents of Harvard, Michigan, and Stanford don't apply for positions like the University of Minnesota. The people who apply are folks, let's say, such as the president of Wichita State. Now, do you think it's humiliating for the president of Wichita State to go back to Wichita and say, I was second out of 200 people for the presidency of a Big Ten university? Does that hurt your reputation? It doesn't. And that's why most states have not changed the law. If this is adopted, the name of everybody who applied but the president, who was ceremoniously then announced by the regents, will be forever secret. Is that good public policy? Does that balance the public interest in this position with the privacy of the candidates? I think it's obvious to everybody that because you're in a fishbowl in that kind of a position, you ought to have some skills. Public access, management of public expectations, willingness to get into the kitchen where the heat is. This eliminates that all in the selection process. It's a bad judgment. Some member of the committee a moment ago mentioned what happened recently with the St. Paul school superintendent selection process, where one of the five finalists turned out to have something of a checkered past. That wasn't discovered by their elite headhunting firm that they hired. That was discovered only after the names of the finalists were disclosed publicly. And we have copies of that article to hand out to the committee. There's no difference here really between St. Paul's school superintendent and presidency at the University of Minnesota. The same issues arise. The same problems will occur if complete secrecy is permitted. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Haas, do you have a question?
Yes, I do have a question or a comment of some type, maybe. I have a hard time judging, you know, how this should work at the top echelon, because I've never had to work at the top echelon. But from the very base to up to that top echelon, the open meeting rule is uncomfortable, but very beneficial. And the newspaper does find things out that you wouldn't find normally, or if it's in the paper, you may get calls that you wouldn't normally get called on. So I'm not too sure how this differs, because it's up one step higher, and that is not in there. Is there some adjustment that you could make to this bill that would be satisfactory to the open meeting rule and still allow some closeness to this process? Is there anything that you could see that you would adjust, or you just think it's all bad policy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawes, it's a good question. I don't want to fail to emphasize that what Representative Abrams is trying to do here is something we'd all support, and that's get the most excellent president at the university we possibly can get. But I do think that the balance has already been struck in past years by the legislature. In other words, only a few names become public. They are disclosed, and those individuals also have to be publicly interviewed. Now, that may be uncomfortable, but it also is arguably a vital part of the process of proper selection. How do they do when finally placed in front of the entire university community and in front of the entire state, for that matter? And so we're more than willing to look at tweaks, but the other thing you got to remember with the regents, there are lots of members. The open meeting law doesn't trigger until a quorum of the public body is in attendance. You could have groups of up to five or six members of the regents sitting down with these folks in complete secrecy, interviewing them, and there would be no open meeting law applicable. So there is a pretty good balance already there.
Representative Riddle.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Anthonson, a couple of quick points. First, I understood you to say that most states don't permit this type of secrecy in the country today. So, in other words, in other states or some most other states, if 200 people applied, then the public would know who the 200 were. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Royal, I think the more, as Regent Berman testified, there's variations everywhere, of course, with these kinds of laws, but I think the most common practice is that a small slate of finalists are made public. Most of the initial applicants are not. To take my Wichita State example, if I go back to Wichita finishing 198th out of 200, I can see that that's a little hard on my ego. But if I'm second, it it's quite different. I think that's usually where the balance is struck.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Anthonson, you have no problems with the law as it currently is constructed in Minnesota?
Mr. Anthonson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rudolph, that's probably a little bit of an overstatement given who I represent, but I will say this. If all the reporters in the room will put down their pencils.
That's an open comment.
Ha ha! That was a joke. I will say this. I think it's a balance that's been in place for 30 years. It's well understood by public officials, and there is a privacy interest here. No one should wink at that or deny it. And so we're going to have to compromise. I think the compromise is a reasonable one right now.
Representative Rudolph.
Mr. Chairman, one final question. Minsky is subject to the same provisions that the hiring of the University of Minnesota president is. Someone from Minsky care to comment on how they feel the procedures work for them?
Welcome to the table, and identify yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Chair Nornis, members of the committee. My name is Bill Cheetah. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Human Resources for the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. Our board has also not taken a position on this legislation. One of the concerns, and I think the reason for the amendment, was that we have a chancellor who is the head of our system, and we have presidents at our various universities, and the way the language was originally construed, it identified the presidents of our institutions who would have been subject to the changes, and I think the comparable position is the chancellor's position. I think that much of the testimony that you've heard about candidates withdrawing from searches when their names will become public, that does happen, and the question really is, what's the right balance?
Thank you.
One more question?
One more. So what do you think the right balance is?
We've only got to 2:15.
Chair Nornis, Representative Earl, I think the issue really revolves more around the public interview process. If you've been to watch one of these, and I didn't get to watch the St. Paul School District lately, but board members are very cautious not to say anything negative about any of the candidates, but try to stress the positives, because certainly if you come in second and the board didn't think you had the fundraising skills necessary or whatever, it is a very difficult thing to do. So I don't have a good answer.
You thought of running for the legislature? Representative Lance?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I guess I don't have any problem with the university not taking an official position on this. Every organization that comes before the legislature decides what their priorities are going to be. And when they make those decisions, they decide maybe they don't want to fill the plate too full in any given year, and so they don't take a position on something in one year that they might deal with some other year. So I don't think that reflects negatively on the U in any way. I will say, over the years, my exposure and communication with members of the Board of Regents at the University of Minnesota has been that this is a serious issue. And having served on legislative bodies at other levels and other organizations that have to go through this kind of a decision-making process, and have served on search committees, it is a challenge, and it is tough to find exactly the right balance. But I, like some others, am convinced, at least like Representative Abler said, there's some concern here. There's some issue here, some legitimate issue about whether or not we're attracting initially the right or the best candidates, let alone when they get through the process to the point where they're about to be named publicly. Maybe Harvard's not applying now, but the current Harvard president is on his way out the door, and maybe time will be when he was unceremoniously forced out of the door.
He was picked in secret, by the way. My point, our resident last month. They're not subject to open meeting law.
But well known to the community when he was selected. But maybe Wichita State is not the level of applicant that we want to run a Big Ten institution either. Maybe the system is set up so that we aren't getting the strongest applicant pool to select from. So I'm not sure exactly what the right balance is either, but I guess I was going to ask a similar question of Mr. Anfinson, and maybe you've already addressed it as much as you're able to today. Is do you see that there's any problem with the current system that could be remedied by closing the process to some further degree that would improve the ability to make sure we get the best possible candidate to run the
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lance, I don't disagree with the thing you've said in terms of the difficulty of this issue. Anybody who stands up and tries to say this is a simple question doesn't know anything about the process and has no experience with it. It's very difficult. There are two strong arguments in counterpoise, and that's what you guys do a lot, is decide those things. I will say this, though. You shouldn't make a change this significant without clear evidence to justify it. That's what is absent. There is no clear evidence that this would improve the process. There's a good chance it would harm the viability of the candidate by you lose accountability over the process. And more subtly, but I think it's important, when these candidates come to town, announced as finalists, and are shopped around the university community and in the news media for the state's citizens, that itself strengthens the ultimate credibility of the candidate who's chosen. And you lose that, too. And so, on balance, I think you lose more than you gain.
Members, again, we have four more bills and at least one more testifier. So, Representative Abrams. Yeah. I would add, only as just a side comment, my solution to this, Representative Abrams, is to hire from within. I think we've got some evidence, so that's a pretty good process. Welcome to the table.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister, and I represent myself as a citizen who's done a large amount of work on issues of privacy
and
practices.
Can also express on you where you're short of time.
Yep.
Boil her down.
How often should colleges and universities be regarding presidential searches? We have the balance now currently. I'd like to share with you an item, a research that was done on this project. In the early 80s, there was Harlan Cleveland, who was with the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, and he did a study about this same issue, about presidential searches. And he said it's lots of problems, lots of issues. And it still has, until a most recent study was done and released in the Chronicle of Higher Education, which I'm sure as members of the Higher Education Committee, you might be heard of that lofty research thing, but it basically does a lot of research and a lot of issues that deal with higher education. They completed a year-long study looking at presidential searches, open meeting, and openness in government. And they came to this conclusion. Seeking a wide public airing of views can be valuable in vetting candidates and in building public support for the selection of a new president. Yet a measure of confidentiality is essential to effectively filling presidencies. Thus, we endorse a balanced approach, one that ensures confidentiality in the search for presidents and openness in the selection of presidents. States should seek to ensure confidentiality for candidates in the early stages of a presidential transition process, which you heard about, where folks can meet four or five under quorum for the open meeting law, but should publicly reveal finalists before reaching any decision and going through a process. And this was the 9th of July 2004, Volume 50, Issue 44. And it's titled, Choose Public College Presidents in the Sunshine, but Know When to Draw the Shades. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as someone who's been on this issue for almost nearly three decades now, short a few years, I think in Minnesota we do have a balanced approach. Can there always be tinkering? Sure. And I've seen plenty of tinkering in all kinds of ways. But one of the things you must have is some documented evidence that say, you know, if you have candidates actually saying, hey, this or that or whatever, and in other kinds of situations, at this point we don't have that. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would encourage you not to go forward with the bill. And I'm speaking as a citizen. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Abrams.
You have four more bills. Just very briefly, I would hope that you consider the seriousness of the issue that's raised. And I would sincerely hope that the Board of Regents, if the bill isn't enacted, doesn't go through a presidential search in which four of you are meeting with the candidate, then another four of you, then another four of you, because that distorts the intent of the law. And I just want to put that on the record, that I would hope that all public institutions would be forthcoming. If they don't like the law, let's change the law, but let's not try to circumvent. But I'd be very happy to work with you, Mr. Chairman, and other members of the committee to try to develop a better process.
I would just say that never happened. There was no regent that ever interviewed any candidate until the so-called finals were selected. It never happened, and it doesn't happen. And I don't think the law permits it, notwithstanding what Mr. Anthonson said this year.
Thank you.
It was
long sue over. We
know that. Yeah, we heard that. I was surprised to hear it. 5 or 6 of us.
You want to renew your motion?
I'll move that House File 3136 be laid over, as amended, be laid over for further consideration and possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education Finance Bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Moving on here to House File 3334. And Representative Eason, do you want to make the motion?
Yeah, I will move House File 3334 be recommended to pass and move to the Education Finance Committee.
That is correct.
And then I'll also move the delete all amendments if we can get the bill.
Do we need a vote on the amendment, on the delete all?
Yeah, I move that
you want us to vote on it right away, and then we'll move on with testimony. All right. All those in favor of the delete all DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I am Sandra Erickson, State Representative from District 16A, a retired teacher and long an advocate of making our or helping our teacher preparation programs to a level of excellence. This bill would develop a report card for our teacher preparation programs that are approved by the State Board of Teaching. And I'll have the page handout a copy from the most recent edition of Education Week, which evaluates all teacher preparation programs, and you will notice that Minnesota received a D+. Part of that, members, is because we have no report card. After this bill was heard in Education Policy and Reform, I went to work trying to hear from teacher prep programs and take into consideration the concerns raised by the members in the Policy and Reform Committee. And that's why you have a delete everything amendment in front of you. I'm delighted to tell you, but a bit saddened, that the only teacher preparation dean who responded to me was Dr. Marilyn Guy, who is dean of my alma mater, Concordia College in Moorhead. And she sent me some excellent, excellent suggestions. And that really is what I've implemented here in the delete all. So let me point out that numbers 3 and 4 that would appear on the report card are now lists, and this is a summary report rather than a data report, because summary then would include the data and the lists. There seem to be questions about being able to submit data on performance-based assessments, even though I realize that it's available, but it is in varying formats, and so to start out, DBR report card could consist of a list. Number 4, changing just a little bit from the original bill, a list of faculty qualifications, and Representative Plowski, you will notice that I specifically inserted their years of experience as K-12 classroom teachers or K-12 school administrators. Number 6 is slightly changed in that I think it's important for us to know where our teacher candidates get jobs. That it's not only in the state of Minnesota, but it's throughout the nation. On the second page of the Delete Everything Amendment, the only issue that's probably raised is in regard to number 10, and I am told that MACD is working on a standard measure of satisfaction from school principals or supervising teachers who have student teachers in classrooms. And I think with the help of MACD, this report card item could be a tool that will be consistent throughout the report card. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will stand for questions and hope that all of you have in front of you the page that I copied from Education Week, which, as you know, is a, I would say, middle-of-the-road publication. It is neither conservative nor liberal, so I think we did a good measure of our teacher prep program.
Representative Erickson, how many testifiers do you have?
None, Mr. Chair, unless they would like to ask Mr. Bittman some questions about licensure.
I was going to hold questions until we have heard from, there are some in the audience that want to speak to this. Representative Erdahl, do you have a question right now?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Erickson, I was just wondering, the number of National Board Certified Teachers, why there is such a wide variety. For example, North Carolina, which I think is a fairly similar size state to Minnesota, having 8,280 board-certified teachers, and in Minnesota just 255. Why is that? Do they offer financial incentives in those other states to become certified, and do we here in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, my name is Daniel Bittman, Director of Licensing at the Department of Education. While the National Board isn't currently under my preview, I will say that there are states that do offer incentives, as well as states that are entertaining some type of reciprocity as far as licensing. Minnesota has kind of gone back and forth on the issue, and I understand that there is some legislation being proposed to address some possible grants or funding for such endeavors.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, in some states, the national certification is a licensure to teach any place. And I'm not sure that Minnesota is ready to go there, at least this author's not. But that is probably why there's a large number in some of those states.
Thank you. Russ Stanton, you want to step to the table here? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Russ Stanton. I represent the Interfaculty Organization. It's the faculty that prepare over half of the teachers in the state of Minnesota. And I'd like to testify in opposition to the bill. When I first saw the bill, I sent it out to our faculty on the campuses and asked for responses. And generally speaking, the responses were as follows. First of all, the bill calls for the collection of massive amounts of data, and that takes a lot of time. Time that could be spent preparing teachers and teaching students, and instead it'll be collecting data and reporting it. Secondly, it costs money, and there's no appropriation in this bill, and so it involves essentially an unfunded mandate on the local colleges and universities that prepare teachers. I would point out this doesn't just affect the public institutions, it affects the private institutions also. And when we're told to just absorb these kinds of costs, I know who absorbs them. The student absorbs them in the price of higher tuition when the state does not provide money. Also, it is a feeling that the legislation simply isn't needed. We already have a program approval process, a very rigorous program approval process through the Board of Teaching, where these programs are reviewed regularly. We also have the NCATE accreditation process where these programs are approved. And frankly, the current system is working quite well. We are recognized as having one of the most highly qualified teaching courses in the nation. Our students are recruited from across the from schools across the nation. The graduates are. If you look at the Minnesota education system, we have the highest graduation rate in the United States. Our ACT scores and SAT scores are among the best in the nation. despite the fact that our funding ranks 24th in the nation per capita. The current system is, not only are our scores near the top, they've been improving substantially over the last couple decades. The current system is working. The professionals that prepare our teachers, I think, deserve at least a little bit of quality for the good teaching task force that we have out there. They're doing a good job. They don't need to be micromanaged from the legislature, and they should just be allowed to do what they're doing because they're doing a good job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nornis and committee. The Board of Teaching would absorb most of the costs, and in K-12 we'll review that appropriation. I received an email from Al Hoffman, the Executive Director, and he thought the cost to the Board of Teaching would be about $20,000. So in K-12, if we think we need to appropriate for them, we'll do so. But, Mr. Chair and committee, a lot of this information is available. You will notice that I did combine number one with the former number three. And colleges have all this information available. HESO, under the direction of Susan Hegard, will collect this data and then forward it to the department and the Board of Teaching. So numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, that's all information that's readily available, especially now that number 3 is a list of performance-based assessments and not the actual data, which is, by the way, annually reported in Title II federal report and available on some websites. All colleges have a list of faculty qualifications and know what the dossier is on each faculty member. Number 5, the average time resident and non-resident program students who graduated from each program needed to complete the program is information important to us. And you will notice that Representative Plowski in particular, I heard this concern raised by Representative Carlson in education policy, and so we have separated resident and non-resident. And colleges keep that data because they are interested in knowing how long it does take their students to complete. The other data that's readily available is the passing rates on skills and subject matter exams. The Board of Teaching annually reports that to us. I'm not sure you read the reports, but I do. And in regard to standard measure of satisfaction, that is something that MACD is working on, and it is something that the Board of Teaching welcomes and would like to use in their program reviews. So, Mr. Chair, with that, if there are other testifiers,
I believe there may be one or two more in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill. Would you come forward, please? Identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Crist. I work for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities System. I want to assure you, first of all, that MSCU is committed to quality and accountability, and we welcome the opportunity to focus on those, along with many others. But what I'd like to briefly address relative to that, to this bill, are three issues. Those are the issues of value, need, and cost. First, the value of the data identified to be collected we think is uneven. Let me give you a few examples of problems. Student entrance requirements for programs and SAT and ACT score data tell us more about the selectivity of the institution than the quality of a program or of teacher graduates. As input measures, they tell us little or nothing about the quality of a program. It's pretty easy. I don't have to say much. To help you recognize the fact that it's a little easier for a Carleton College, perhaps, to attract somebody with a very high ACT or SAT than it is a state university. But I would tell you that the quality of our programs and our graduates are just as good. Second example, time to degree. That tells us much more about the financial and social realities of students in the program. For example, how many hours a student may have to work each week in order to afford to attend college, and the other demands that he or she may be juggling as a single parent or a working mother. than about the program. Third example, the number of required credits. In our system, there's a narrow range of allowable credits for any of our four-year degree programs, so measuring and reporting this really tells us nothing about the programs themselves. In fourth example, placement rates of graduates. They tell us at least as much about job availability as they do about the quality of a program or its graduates. When we look at how many positions are being cut in school districts right now in tight budget times, and we see that previously higher teachers who have been cut are the first to be recalled, it won't matter how good the quality is of our new graduates if there aren't positions into which they might be hired. Secondly, need. We would say that the need for a new mechanism, another mechanism to collect data, is questionable. I think you've already heard that MASTE has created a system, Measures of Teacher Quality in Minnesota, for collecting and reporting statewide data. I would suggest it would be more cost-effective to work with that system to consider the need to refine or add measures than to create a new system for reporting data. Now, our system, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, has invested significant time and energy and resources to establish its own comprehensive accountability system. We're also working with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education and their efforts to establish a statewide accountability system. And all of our institutions have to be accredited by the Higher Learning Commission, approved by the Board of Teaching, and they have to annually report Title II data to the federal government. There's a lot of data being collected and reported. We don't believe another system is needed. And third, cost of collecting data. I think it's a little more complex and a little more expensive than may appear to be the case on the surface. I don't know about you, but I keep all of my records, everything I need to know when my husband and I file our income taxes. But the fact that I have all of those in a folder doesn't mean it doesn't take me time to sort through them all, do some calculations, read the rules, figure out what happens, read the rules again. And I think the same thing is true with our data. It's true that much of what might be reported may be in place at our institutions, but that underestimates, if you look at that as a simple fact, the time it takes to cull through that data, to enter it in the data system, to report it. We estimated at a minimum the cost to our system with seven institutions that prepare teachers being at least $225,000 a year to undertake this data collection. And that may well be a conservative estimate. And at that, it does not cover the cost of the other 22 teacher preparation institutions in Minnesota. These are dollars that we believe could be better spent serving students rather than collecting or redefining data, much of which we think will tell us little about the quality of program outputs. In addition, investments already made by some of our institutions to build their own institutional comprehensive assessment systems would now be lost or duplicated by requiring them to collect new or different data. They may collect some similar data, but define it slightly differently. And with a new definition, they'd have to go through a whole new process of collecting data. The estimated cost of that for systems for institutions already collecting data could go as high as $500,000. It just takes a lot of people and technology to do all of the data definitions, entry collection, and reporting. I'd also like to address one other point briefly. Since Representative Erickson distributed a page from the Quality Counts report, first of all, I'd like to say that the Quality Counts grade on teacher preparation is not, in fact, a measure of the quality of those programs. It measures the policies and practices in the state. It reports to you on the number of national board certified teachers. It reports on how we define teacher preparation. Minnesota gets graded lower than many states because instead of just counting how many credits our students complete to become teachers, we've defined the standards of effective practice. And if you've read those standards recently, you know that those are very high quality and rigorous standards. But Education Week only counts credits. Minnesota falls short on that measure. It bases its grades also on things like whether the state requires and funds induction and mentoring for new teachers. Minnesota does not do that. Education Week recognizes that that's a critical factor in teacher quality. Minnesota is graded low because as a state we don't provide it. You may wish to look at other pages in this report that measure how well our students learn to get a little better sense of the impact of our teachers. So, in conclusion, I'd like to say we applaud the goal of ensuring that Minnesota's teacher preparation programs are the highest quality. We're proud of the number of Minnesota institutions that have demonstrated their quality by having achieved national accreditation. We take great pride in the continuing high level of student performance in Minnesota, only possible because of the quality of fine teachers like Representative Pawlowski and so many more across the state. We're not suggesting that we should not be held accountable, nor that we can't continue to improve. What we are suggesting is that there are better ways to invest our limited human and fiscal resources, and that the state of Minnesota would be better served by undertaking a thoughtful, collaborative, and comprehensive process for determining how to measure and assure the quality of teacher preparation in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl, do you have a question of the author?
Well, another one just came up, Mr. Chairman. But, well, there's more than one public school teacher up here, by the way.
I just asked if it's
for which. And many others. Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, and many others.
All right, thank you. Well, just, Mr. Chairman, quickly, and I do want to applaud Representative Erickson for bringing forward this concern. I do have some questions about how this would change it, looking at this this quality counts report.
Representative Erdahl, can I again clarify? Are you asking the author this question? Or you could dismiss the other witness.
You could dismiss the other witness.
I have a question for the witness.
Okay, then, stay where you are.
Okay.
members, we also are going to stay until we finish our bill, so clear the calendars.
Mr. Chairman, I'm last, so mine will go really quickly.
Hold the house. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, it seems in comparing this report with the bill that very few of the items here, as I believe Ms. Crisp was saying, are addressed or would be changed if the bill were implemented. And therefore, would our grade actually increase very much? Once again, most anything up here dealing with finances that we are not currently graded on because we don't do. And since we're not addressing those things, would this really change anything in terms of the report, Representative Erickson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, well, our grade hasn't changed in several years, so I think we could at least move to a C+ with the report card, since that seems to be something important for accountability today, whether it's K-12 or now teacher preparation.
Okay. Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And since I was satisfied with a C+ in my econ grade in college, I'll go along with
mine.
Representative Lance?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The numbers that you suggested, the $200,000 for your institution and whatnot, would that be the number in the first year of putting the information together? And the reason I ask is that I would expect, sometimes it's tough to get all the information together initially, but once you're expecting to have to provide it every year, you start collecting it as the information is gathered, and the process becomes much more streamlined and less expensive.
Ms. Chris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Latz, I think that it would be reasonable to assume that the costs might go down somewhat here. However, as I'm sure you know, there are costs with maintaining the system. New data has to be input every year if you're continuing to measure, the number of graduates, the test scores, and so on each year. So we don't estimate that the costs would be significantly less in subsequent years. Partly that's because we would anticipate that much of our data collection work would be managed out of the Office of the Chancellor on behalf of the system. So the institutional costs would involve their entry of data and their work to ensure that it was accurate and up to date each year. There would continue to be significant central costs then to following up, making sure all the data was correct, analyzing it, and reporting it.
Representative Lyons?
Just a comment. I generally object to unfunded mandates. Having served in local government, they're very annoying. And they're often a way to, for the level of government above you to pass the buck. If you want to say they accomplish something, but then not being willing to find the money to prioritize the funds to accomplish it. But then there are some things that other levels of government simply ought to be doing for their own internal accountability processes, whether it's mandated by the state or not. And so I think we may be in one of those gray areas here in this particular case. We passed the graduation standards requirements and redid all of the K-12 standards. I offered an amendment to fund the costs of the local school districts transitioning to all of that, including purchasing new textbooks and whatnot, all the time that they'd have to do in terms of teacher training and curriculum changes and stuff like that. And I'd like to see us at least know what it is that we're doing here in terms of costs. So if we make a decision that we want to pass all of it on or half of it on or none of it on, that we can do so in an educated fashion. I'm not sure if this is the Finance Committee where that ought to be considered or not. But
this bill does go to the K-12 Finance Division from here.
The cost would be imposed.
Pass the buck to them.
Well, the cost here would in fact be borne by higher education institutions. I understand it. So, I support the policy behind the bill. And frankly, I support the mechanism behind the bill. I'm just concerned about the costs.
Representative Plosky?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, just a couple of questions. Education Week, which is a very large periodical, given the size of these pages, what do we gain by raising from D minus to C or B? What advantage is there to Minnesota in doing so? Or the amount of money that we're looking at here, which varies from $20,000 to $500,000?
Representative Erickson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Plosky, I don't know what your former students tell you when they come to visit you after they have become teachers, but a repeated criticism I heard was that other students on campuses think that if you enter the profession of teaching and are enrolled in a teacher prep program, that you're taking the easy way out. And though Education Week is certainly not a measure, Education Week is one publication that lets us know where we stand in relation to other states. My goal is to raise the standard within our teacher prep programs so that there is no student on a campus who thinks a teacher prep program is the easy way out. And I think you and I agree that certainly more content. You know, when I graduated from Concordia in 1964, my teacher preparation was based solely on content. I had one methods course, and I had child psychology. Otherwise, it was all content in the area of English. And I really felt that I left Concordia at the same level as the English majors did because of the content that was in place. So though this report card and Education Week may not be the publication or the standard to look at, I think that each time we take a closer look at our teacher prep programs, to move towards standards of excellence and make these content-driven courses. You know, a report card will reveal to us what we need to improve teacher preparation so that we do have programs that carry the kind of recognition that I want our candidates who choose teaching and our professionals to be able to reflect on. And I know that was a long answer to your question.
Representative Erickson, I usually don't say something like this, but I will. I've taught 15 years as adjunct faculty at Winona State, specifically teaching students to be social studies teachers. I teach it out of my classroom at the high school. I've never had one of them come up and talk to me about Education Week or the ratings in this periodical. I have not had them come up and tell me specifically that they have thought that going into the profession was somehow a lesser of the other professions on campus. In fact, I've had a number of them who probably could have gone into other professions, and if you're just looking economically, made a great deal more, but thought this was a calling, not just a profession to go into. But my concern with this, subsequent to having your bill heard in full committee, and then having it moved up here, the Minnesota Association of Colleges of Teachers of Education is a unique entity. It has both the private colleges and the public colleges. They have raised concerns that go beyond just the cost and the duplication and the fact that this may have, in fact, no improvement at all on either our private colleges or public colleges of education as they prepare teachers. And that bothers me, that as your intention is good, what might happen won't be good. And we have had, in Minnesota, 150 years of experience in teaching teachers how to teach. I know I've got the oldest institution in my district that started just preparing teachers. That's how Winona State started, as a teacher's college. So can you tell me, could we do this? Could MACTI do what you want to do without having a bill? Could MinSCU and the private colleges and MACTI do what you need to do here without a bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, perhaps. But, you know, what I find in report cards, as I think about the K-12 report cards, is that districts pay a lot of attention to their programs and their achievement because there is something that's very public. And I maneuvered my way through measuring quality website. And, I think that we can have a much more consumer-friendly website if we delegate this to the Board of Teaching, who, of course, is under the purview of the Department of Education. And I think when you make things public in a particular way, that colleges are going to sit up and pay attention to that comparison, just as we do in the K-12 arena, through the report card. And the public, future students, principals for hiring, or who else, human resource directors, I think this raises the anxiety level, and it makes colleges pay attention. And when I made my statement about what students have said to me, they're telling me what other students say about teacher prep programs, not what they think of teacher prep programs, what other students have said to them in college.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Arizona,
you know, I don't think any of this information isn't necessarily public. It just isn't in the form that you want. And I wish you would have testified on the previous bill. I think your stressing on making things public might have helped us on this last bill.
thank you. I'm a former journalist.
English teacher.
You have comments in regards to the question?
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski,
yes.
Okay. We have a testifier. Please identify yourself.
Carmen Cobayes Vega. I'm Dean of the College of Professional Studies at Metropolitan State University, and I am here representing the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. I'm currently serving on the executive board of that group. And I'm not going to read the statement to you totally. I'm just going to address a few points, and then I would like to respond to a couple of points that have been raised briefly.
Go ahead. Again, we hope to get three more bills done here in the next half hour.
I know. That'll be brief. I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, and we express our concern about the House Bill 334. MACTI values assessment and accountability. We believe that all institutions that prepare teachers should demonstrate their capacity to do so. In fact, it is only after meeting the high standards set by the Board of Teaching that higher ed institutions are able to prepare teachers for licensure in Minnesota. There are some significant concerns, as you've heard raised, about the resources that would be needed to do this, what is required or requested in this bill. In addition, higher education was not consulted regarding what is available or what might be used to provide information to the public. The bill appears to call for standard measures for all institutions, sort of that one size fits all, and we're not all the same. We are large, small, public, private, rural, urban, and so on. The development of instruments is costly, and administration of the instruments is also costly. We object on these grounds. It's a proposal that appears to require significant additional resources in order to comply. It creates a model of higher education accountability in the form of an overly simplistic report card. It was developed without consulting higher education. You've heard the comments by our colleague from Minsky, Cindy Christ, about the cost that it would be to Minsky institutions, and we haven't even tallied the cost for the private institutions in the state. We have a fair number of processes in place currently that help us to look at ourselves, to look at what we do, to set that accountability, and processes that we currently have in place. Our institutions are approved by the Board of Teaching and the Minnesota Department of Education, and we have to do a very thorough analysis of what we are engaged in terms of the quality of teacher ed programs. Teacher ed programs have in fact changed over the past 20 to 30 years, where we have candidates in classrooms earlier and earlier in their preparation time. So it's not just one methods course that people have and then go out and student teach. Another thing is the bill doesn't really address graduate programs. And we do have graduate teacher ed programs in our universities. The issue of comparing teacher-ed institutions with each other as a way to kind of keep us awake, make us aware, really denies the opportunity that we have in choices that we make and that we provide to our citizens to make those choices as to what institution they will choose, public, private, rural, urban, regional. And so I think that we have to be very careful about this notion of how we compare institutions. All of our institutions are different. They have different missions. They have different constituents that they report to, and they serve a number of different communities in the state of Minnesota. Therefore, I really respectfully request that you reconsider this bill, because we do not feel that this is a bill that will help support teacher ed, but will take away time from precious other efforts that we have ongoing. We are more than willing to talk through, aside from having the bill, talk through a process utilizing what we have currently in place, that MACTI has in place, with consultation with the institutions that we have as part of our membership, to look at a process that might achieve the same goal, but maybe won't cost as much, because cost is an issue here. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, just to underscore, this is an organization that represents both our private and public colleges of education, correct?
Yes.
So the statement that you're reading to us is from both,
yes,
private and public colleges?
Yes.
All right. And the University of Minnesota?
Yes.
All are higher.
We're all the same. We're all in it together.
The only other observation I'd have would be, it sounds like a profile of teacher evaluation, but I just say that shortly.
Mr. Chair and committee, I'm looking at all the data that is collected by either a federal report or by the Board of Teaching, and it's almost in every one of these report card items. So I think it is a matter of submitting the data to HESO and then to the Board of Teaching, if the Board of Teaching indeed does not already have this. But completion time is in the Title II ESEA report, and of course colleges have on record their Title II federal report, so that would be a list of the performance-based assessments.
Any other questions? Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just did my income tax over the weekend, so I'm kind of trying to see a correlation here. There's a lot of data that goes into an income tax report, and you know, I might be very comfortable that I know what all the data is, but if somebody else is going to make any sense out of it, it needs to be consolidated in a filing.
And I think that's all we're doing here. What we're saying, there's tons of data out there. We're not refuting that fact at all. We're just saying, give it to us in a forum that can consolidate it so we can see what it all means. And I think I see that as being a beneficial to a legislator whose job is to provide some oversight. And I think it's beneficial for everybody because it's going to help every person in the or every entity that's in there providing that data, because it's going to provide a framework for it all to make better sense. So I think this is a good policy. I agree with Representative Lapps. The cost seems to be all over the map. And I think I would just encourage us, let's pass this on to the K-12 committee and let them deal with the dollars. And if there's reason to believe we can afford it or can't afford it, I think they can make that decision.
Representative Lance. He's got some responsibility. Well, Office of Higher Education would have some responsibilities here, too, and we haven't heard from them with regard to any fiscal implications for them. And there's no fiscal note apparently attached to the bill. So, is it in the packet? And what are the numbers? Have you already looked at it? I'll be taking the time to look at it before we go.
Mr. Burke, can you quickly summarize?
Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note is preliminary. It hasn't been signed off on, and the amendment, of course, would potentially make some difference. BINSCU's costs are, as Ms. Chris testified, around $225,000 with potential other costs if they had to develop separate assessment tools. The university reports potential costs of about $75,000 per campus, $300,000 in ongoing costs, and also makes the same qualification that if they had to develop separate performance-based assessments, that there would be substantial additional costs. Office of Higher Education was not on the fiscal note. Mr. Mizekanis is in the audience. I'm sure he can testify quickly on whether or not.
Chair and members, Representative Lapps, Mark Chance with the Office of Higher Education. Again, we were not asked to do a fiscal note, so we didn't produce any numbers, although looking at the list of requirements under the bill, I have to say there's some things here that we have a fairly substantial data collection part of our office, so I don't see any problem with it. To the extent that, for instance, on page 2, line 5, you're looking for surveys that weren't already undertaken, there might be some things that would lead to higher costs. So it kind of depends on what is in the
Mr. Chair.
In the mix.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, to the fiscal note, I'll ask Mr. Berg. We haven't heard from the private colleges, but would the private college cost be commensurate with the MINSCU cost? Could someone from the private colleges tell us that we're looking at a cost similar to that? I see.
Representative Pulaski, that the private colleges are not on the fiscal note. They're not being
a public. I understand.
I don't know. They have not approached me about the issue.
Is there someone from your private colleges who give us a ballpark?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, John Clemens from the Minnesota Private College Council. Representative Klawski, I can't tell you the exact number, but our folks do tell us that the cost will be high. And there's also some disagreement about even whether they can supply all the information. Some believe they can supply it all. Some believe that they cannot. And our position is the same as the MINSCU folks, that we would prefer the present law. And I will try and get those numbers to you as fast as possible. But we do believe that the cost would be considerable. And there's no reason to believe our costs would be any less than the public. And as Representative Stanton said, they would come through tuitions mainly.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. That's very helpful.
Representative Lance.
Mr. Chairman, given this information, since we are the Higher Education Finance Committee, it seems to me it's our responsibility to make decisions with regard to any funding or fiscal impact that might be incurred by the Office of Higher Education, MINSCU, or the University of Minnesota, not K-12 finance. So, Mr. Chairman, at this point, I think it would be more appropriate for us to hold on to this bill until we can decide if there's going to be a higher education finance bill, and if there's any money in there, then we can make some decisions about funding, and I'll be voting in accordance with that precept.
Representative Erickson, do you know why this bill was to go back to K-12 finance?
Mr. Chair and Committee, because the Board of Teaching and the Department of Education are the organizations, these agencies that have purview over this. And my conversations with Susan Hegard, because so much of this is already in rule, at least three-fourths of these items are already in rule requested through either rule that's in place, and I quote 8700.7600 repeatedly, and because these are on federal reports, and no longer am I asking for the performance assessment, I'm asking for a list of what they use. So even those fiscal notes are inaccurate based on the DeLeto amendment.
Mr. Chair, if I could be so bold as to make a suggestion here for your consideration. We're having trouble, some of us here from higher ed, tracking some of Representative Erickson's comments in terms of data we're already collecting, things that are already in rule. I'm not suggesting that she's inaccurate, but it seems to me that it's pretty clear that we really need some further discussion so that all parties that are interested in this accountability can be clear together about what data is being collected, how it's being collected, how it might be reported, what Representative Erickson and others who support these would like to see in a report card, what kinds of information we could provide. So if this bill could be laid over so that all the parties involved might sit down together and work through the issues and reach some shared understanding about the data that's being collected and reported and what steps might be taken, we might be able to come up with something that would satisfy everybody.
Representative Erickson, do you have a suggestion on we can take a vote or we can just...
Mr. Chair and Committee, I was hoping they would have all come to see me since this was heard in policy, and because the only one I heard from was Dr. Guy at Concordia, I thought that was most interesting. But once again, we have in state statute and in rule and in federal requirements much of this, but I would be happy to sit down with the players, with the Department of Education and the Board of Teaching and HESO, and talk about this further if that would please the committee. I'm always open to that.
Would you like to do that on between now and K-12 finance? Or
yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kowalski.
Mr. Chair, I believe that a higher motion keeps the bill further from passing. Is that correct?
Right.
Mr. Chair, I would move we table the bill on this committee.
Motion has been made to table the bill. All of those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The ayes have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Bill is tabled. Okay, we have... Members, if we can get moving, or start moving. 38, House File 3848. Representative Marquardt, welcome to higher ed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for waiting,
Chair,
also.
And members, Noel, this is the first time I think I've officially been back to this committee since I served on it, my first term, so it's nice to be back.
I'll first of all move House File 3848 and move that it be held over or laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3848 is a bill that will help campus officials make the higher education setting safer for students. And at the same time, what it does do, it addresses a very serious concern on campuses around the state, and that is the misuse of alcohol by underage students. And what this will do is it actually links the Minnesota data practices with federal law. And it's somewhat unclear if we can do this or not, and so this would clarify that. It would allow for the notification of parents of students under 21 if there is a law or university institution policy which is violated regarding alcohol or drug use. And currently, the Federal Education and Privacy Rights Law was amended in 1998. And when it was amended in 1998, it allowed, does not require, but allows institutions to notify parents of students who are under 21 years of age that the student has been found responsible for violating institutional rules or policies governing the use or possession of alcohol or controlled substance. The problem is that when Minnesota Data Practices was amended and linked to the federal law, it was done prior to this update of 1998. So what we need to do is link Minnesota Data Practices with this new amendment so that state law can clarify that parents, in fact, can be notified if the student is under 21. And with this bill, it would allow Minnesota State University and colleges around the state to begin developing policies. There have been some questions on purpose and so forth, and this certainly is not punitive. It is to protect students, and it's to get parents involved earlier. And one thing we want to avoid is a parent coming up to a campus official and saying to that campus official, "You knew my child was having problems. Why didn't you call me?" And what this allows, left up to the discretion of the university and college, to look at what's best for the student, inform the parent when that is necessary and prudent to protect the student. And so I would, Mr. Chair, if I have a witness here who is a champion in this area, Dr. Susan Williams from Minnesota State University in Moorhead, who's been a champion in this area and is assistant to the president, she can give you a little more details on things and how it might be used on their campus, for example.
Okay, Ms. Williams. Identify yourself with the tape, please.
My name is Suzanne Williams, S-U-S-A-N-N-E. I'm assistant to the president at Minnesota State University Moorhead. And the reason that I'm here has to do with my role as chair of the president's task force on student alcohol misuse. It's a role that I've held and I've been honored to hold and challenged to hold for the past 2 years. When the group was formed in response to the death of Jason Reinhart, and we continue our work in light of the recent death of Patrick Kaisha. In our community, we've learned an incredible amount about ourselves, about our institution, and then about the surrounding region when it comes to alcohol misuse issues. And it was very enlightening to us to learn that it isn't just an issue that is found on college campuses. But by the same token, there's something about the college environment that causes a spike in the misuse behavior of alcohol. What I'd like to do is provide just a few minutes in looking at context so that you understand where this kind of information is coming from, why we're interested in using parental notification, and I'll share some of the data that I found so enlightening on our campus. What I'm sending around is a collection of maps from the United States, and it's data that's gathered by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And what they've done is look at data from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, and this particular gathering of information is from February 2005. This information is important for us to understand and have a clear picture of for a very important reason, and that is that it's a very clearly illustrated example of how alcohol misuse is a regional issue. You notice in the first map on the top of your stack is looking at students, youth aged 12 to 17, and it's measuring binge use over the past month. The states that are highlighted are the states that lead the rest of the country, and you notice it's concentrated in the upper Midwest. If you go to the next image, we look at age 18 to 25, and Minnesota joins the pack. It, again, is a cultural issue that is illustrated in the upper Midwest. If you look at the third slide, or the third image, we're looking at adults, age 26 and over, and again, binge alcohol use continues to be something that is an upper Midwest issue. We own this problem, but it's up to us to step forward and come up with proactive solutions, solutions that are research-based and evidence-based, which is why I'm here. If you take the next slide, this, or the image that has the dots all over the rest of the country, what this particular piece has done is look at metropolitan areas, and they gather data from the U.S. cities that had enough to be included in this particular study, and it was published by the American Journal of Public Health. They found that the problem age isn't too surprising. It's age 18 to 34, and it's clearly a problem of our males. But what they did on the map, and you'll notice that there are a lot of dots that are darker on the map, those are the top 20 metropolitan communities for binge drinking behaviors. 12 of the top 20 metropolitan communities in the United States are in the upper Midwest. Fargo-Moorhead, where I'm from, is 20th in the country. Just a little bit north, Grand Forks is number 2 in the country. 12 of the top 20 metropolitan communities lead the rest of the nation. If you flip to the last map, it combines the data that they have with respect to state prevalence rates and again the community prevalence rates. And again, you see it's clearly an issue that belongs to the upper Midwest. I included the last image there for you so you can see the top 20 communities just for your information. Parental notification is an important piece that has been missing in our response to address alcohol misuse issues. And it's not a silver bullet. There is no one single answer to addressing these types of behaviors. But what we do know is that we must address the behaviors from a comprehensive environmental management approach. That involves looking at everything in the environment that encourages students to say yes to high-risk drinking. And believe me, there are a lot of conflicting messages that are out there. Everything from how our parents or how adults model the behavior for their younger ones to how, if you look at the advertisements that flood student newspapers that encourage high risk and rapid consumption of alcohol, the 2-for-1s, the 3-for-1s, to looking at issues such as policy and enforcement, and are the policies correctly in place and are they enforced strictly and clearly. All of those things have got to work together in addition to the education piece. We need to be able to have the ability to involve parents at a point in their student's life or in their son or daughter's life when they need help. As Paul Marquardt told you, this is not a punitive thing. It's looking at students who are age 18 to 21. What it does is allow us to be able to notify and bring the parents in. For example, if a student is in the hospital being treated for detox, and if we can't tell parents something like that, how can we possibly provide all of the help from all the necessary people that love and care for that individual the most? Of course, it can't be a blanket policy. That's why the federal law says colleges and universities may involve parents. We know that involving parents at every step or in every family is not necessarily the best in the best interest for every individual. At Minnesota State University Moorhead, our institution wants to use this type of approach to be able to work with our counselors, work with our health services professionals, and work with that individual student to determine if parental notification would indeed be the best course. Alcohol issues are difficult for any of us to deal with and grapple with this because, as I illustrated, it's such a cultural accepted behavior. But what we're getting at are the very extreme behaviors, and I want to close with just one last point. That has to do with a lot of individuals will ask me, has alcohol use changed? I drank when I was in college, I'm just fine. My kids drank. My kids may drink now. Let me tell you that alcohol use is changing. The data nationally tells us that there is a larger group of students that are engaging in the high-risk behaviors, drinking 5 or more drinks in a 2-hour sitting. The purpose is to get extremely drunk, extremely intoxicated. And sometimes folks say, well, that's what we did. Well, the difference is we drank beer. They're drinking the very the hard stuff, the flavored vodkas, the flavored alcohols, and so on. And the police that we work with in our community have told us repeatedly that they are seeing that the students that they pick up and charge with whatever alcohol offense they may be charged with are showing higher alcohol concentration in their blood, higher blood alcohol levels. That's what's changing. But by the same token, we're having a larger group of students that are actually abstaining. So larger pocket of the high risk, larger pocket of the abstainers, shrinking middle ground. That's why it's so different. It's an issue that we need to step forward and address from multiple ways, and parental notification is one key response that must be in place for an entire environmental management perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Marquardt. It's obvious students probably have some discretionary money. When I was in school, we didn't have money to smoke or drink. So, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Marquardt, very good bill. Thank you for bringing it forward. I've had phone calls from constituents who have complained to me about incidences involving their children and drinking on college campuses that they tried to check into and, you know, ran into a closed door, couldn't find out anything. I think that they are entitled to know with their children under 21 what they are running into in this type of occurrence on campus. So again, good bill. I think we could just vote and move on.
Oh,
that didn't work.
I don't know who's first here now. Representative Dempsey?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, what are some of the solutions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dempsey, I think the important thing is there isn't a silver bullet, as Dr. Williams mentioned. But I do believe that getting parents involved and doing whatever we can to help address when students are having these problems before it's too late. And we've seen that happen, where not everyone that we can bring to the table to help solve a problem when students are having misuse as far as alcohol or drugs. We need to bring everyone to the table as soon as possible. There is no silver bullet, and it's a number of things. But one thing is to get out, and I know Dr. Williams is doing this in the Fargo-Moorhead area, get the message out that it is a serious problem. It can have devastating effects on people's lives, much less their educational careers. And that's, you know, let's add one more tool. Let's bring one more player to the table in a higher education setting to be able to do something for that student before it's too late.
We have a student, I think, that would like to also testify for a few moments. Is that all right, Mr. Representative Carlson?
I had a question for Dr. Williams, but if he's available.
Go ahead.
Mine is just a quick one. Both the author and yourself have continually used the word parent. And my background as a teacher, we were always careful to say parent or guardian. It's a little hard to tell from the bill if guardians are included or not, because you're just referencing, as I understand it, the federal code.
Dr. Williams.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, yes, parents or guardian, and I apologize for eliminating that term, but parents or guardian.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. If we could have a student who wanted to testify, step forward, please. And we're going to do two more bills before session. I apologize for the length here, but it's important we have this discussion. So, please identify yourself.
Christopher Braddock, Vice President, Minnesota State University Moorhead Student Senate. And as a student senator, I understand how long meetings can be a little annoying, so I'll get straight to the point. Thank you for allowing me to testify, Mr. Chair. I'm a sophomore in Moorhead. As a higher education student in the state of Minnesota, I believe alcohol is a serious problem that is only growing in intensity. Over the last few years, my campus has suffered the tragic loss of two students. This is an alarming trend, and as a student leader, I feel not only should our administration be working to curb it, but students should be involved as well. I think this is a key piece of legislation because it will help the university provide assistance to those students who need our help. It's been alluded to that there have been issues in the recent issues that would this bill would have assisted in, and I'd like to tell you about just one of those. My administration has told me that this academic year, there was a young lady who, in her freshman year developed a problem with alcohol. Back in September, they were made aware of her. She began counseling with the administration. Over the winter break, her alcohol problem turned into a meth problem. Before spring break, she was taken to the emergency room, and at that point, her parents were notified because that was the first time the university was allowed to notify her parents that she had an issue. And the only response they had for her incredibly angry father, who had every right to be angry, was, "State law does not allow us to tell you these things. We're not allowed to disclose to you your child's problems. Everyone wants to help her, but we're not allowed to." And I think that's a tragedy. It's a tragedy that we would allow any student with a problem that serious to stay such a self-destructive course. I personally know of several students who would benefit from the acts of this bill. There's nobody that cares more about these students than their parents, and granting universities the ability to make them aware of these issues will prove crucial in the future. I firmly believe it will actually save lives. Some students will argue that when we go to college, we're adults, and we should be treated like adults. The simple fact is that adulthood doesn't begin at any particular age. If I were 18 or 19 years old and not in college, I believe my friends and family would intervene if I had a serious problem. There's no logical reason to allow universities to shield students from the help they need and rightfully deserve. As a 27-year-old student who was raised in the Midwest, I lived in three of the top 20 cities where binge drinking is an issue. From the ages of 15 to 23, drinking was my life. And thankfully, I've moved past that, and I have the gift of retrospect now that I understand that a bill like this truly is beneficial to all students.
Thank you very much. I would renew my original motion that House File 3848 pass and be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And it's a very good bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you so much.
Representative Eastland, I hate to rush your time, but if we can, say, shoot for 10 minutes, yep. We'll do the same for Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'd like to thank you for just the opportunity to have a hearing on this bill. I have an amendment, and I'm not going to offer the amendment because I think the bill is probably not going to go any place in the Senate. It's not ready for prime time, but I think it's an issue that deserves some discussion, and I think we would benefit from the discussion.
Would you like to move the bill so it's in?
Okay, so I can move House File 3690 will be before the committee for discussion. One of the things that we struggle with a lot in this committee, and I guess as a member of this committee that hasn't been here very many years, it's amazing how I've seen the tuition issue become such a major obstacle for us to deal with here. It's a struggle. This bill looks at the tuition issue and tries to bring some stability to it. This is a concept that's happening all around the country in public universities as well as private universities. And I guess what I was intrigued with is the evolution of this bill, how it got here. And so what I've done is I've asked Senator Gerlach, who is the author of the bill in the Senate, to make a few comments about the guaranteed tuition bill, and then he has some testify as he would like to testify.
Welcome, Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be back here in the House Committee. I appreciate your hospitality. I should identify myself as Senator Chris Gerlach, and I am thankful for Representative Eastland in authoring this bill in the House. I'm also working on it in the Senate, and it's been introduced. I actually have Senator Pappas as a co-author on it, and she also believes that it deserves merits some discussion and further pursuits. The genesis of this idea really came to me from a student in my district, Katie Shaw, who is behind me and has a few comments to make about this. She, like many students in high school, as they look forward to higher education with their aspirations, struggle with the uncertainty and the rising costs. Now, we know that there's never enough money in the system. We know that, and we work hard, everybody on this committee here, and everybody works hard to try to solve that. But aside from that, is there anything else that can be done to help put some stability and some certainty and stabilization in some of these rising costs? So Katie had written to me and had this idea, so I said, well, let's talk about it some more. We met. We actually then met with some of our research folks in the Senate and came up with an idea. We found that in Illinois, that the University of Illinois has a plan put together called the Tuition Guarantee Plan, and it says in their literature here it's designed to insulate students from the sporadic fluctuations in the tuition rates at the university's campuses, yet enable this university to keep pace with the cost of providing a high-quality education. The plan makes college expenses stable and predictable. It also ensures that the university is affordable for all academically qualified students regardless of their income. And it says that the Illinois lawmakers said that the intent of this legislation was to address the concern among students and their families about the affordability of a public university education and the difficulties of planning for educational costs that can change appreciably over 4 years that are required for most degree programs. The University of Illinois supported the legislation that passed in the spring of 2003, and they formed a committee. They didn't do all the details in the legislation because there's a 100 or 1,000 little details about how this could be implemented, but they left that up to the university system, and what they did is they formed a committee, and they put together all of the details, and then that was approved, and they have been working on this program now for the last couple of years. That's where this came from, and I think that it holds a lot of merit for us to discuss in Minnesota about how we can try to provide some stability in these costs. Right now, I'd like to hear a few words from Katie Shaw, a student from Apple Valley. Actually, you're from Eagan, right? If you could identify your name and where you're from.
My name is Katie Shaw, and I am a high school student at the School of Environmental Studies in Apple Valley. And I feel lucky to have grown up in a generation where many of the people get the opportunity to attend one form of higher education or another, and in this society that we have that values education for its citizens. Because I've recently found out, while applying to colleges, a critical factor for many people in continuing in higher education is financial limitations. Tuition is a somewhat expected burden for most people that attend a secondary education, but another problem that is often less addressed is the stability of that tuition. With the year-to-year increases in tuition that have been occurring, many students have had to make the decision as to whether they will be able to continue with the degree they have started. Because of this problem, many prospective students are deterred from attending colleges or universities, or current students are forced to drop out of schools where they already are enrolled. I saw this continuing trend increasing, and as a result, I tried to come up with a pragmatic solution. A guaranteed tuition plan would be a positive way to alleviate the problems of tuition fluctuation and help encourage participation by students in higher education for three reasons. First, it will give students a clear picture of the financial situation they will face in their next years at the institution, and it would allow them to plan according to that plan accordingly. Second, it would also draw people to Minnesota institutions that otherwise might not pursue education because it would allow them the stability in their choice to invest in their education. Lastly, the plan would encourage students to finish their degree in a timely manner because the plan places a limit on the amount of time a student is guaranteed that tuition rate. This means students would have an economic advantage to finishing their degree faster. This bill is not meant to place a burden and take it off students and place it on institutions or the state. It is simply a way for students to be aware of the endeavor they are going to take part in. In order to ensure that institutions don't have to bear the weight of fixed tuition costs, the plan would allow for small increases in tuition based on the consumer price index. This way, as the cost of running an institution increases, so does the amount of revenue the institution is gaining from tuition. Each new incoming class at the institution would also have a different guaranteed rate of tuition. This allows the institutions to make adjustments to the tuition rate of each incoming class as need be. The cost of having a guaranteed tuition rate wouldn't fall on the incoming students either. Many private colleges in Minnesota, including St. Olaf and Gustavus, already offer a guaranteed cost plan to their students that allows the students to pay a small upfront fee and then locks the students into a tuition rate with a 4 or 5% increase in tuition annually. The University of Illinois also has a state-mandated guaranteed tuition plan, which was supported by the university, that allows students to pay the same tuition each year after an initial increase. The university found that after their first year of implementing the guaranteed tuition plan, that the increases in tuition for the next incoming class was estimated to be the same as the increase in tuition the class would have faced without the guaranteed tuition plan. A guaranteed tuition plan would be a way to allow for an equilibrium between quality education and affordable education for students. This bill would allow more Minnesota residents to confidently pursue their education goals and would send a message to all residents that education is important to our state.
Thank you. There are some others in the audience that may have a reaction to this or a comment, if we can... Senator Gerlach?
Mr. Chairman, I just also wanted to recognize as well there are two additional students here with Katie Shaw that have taken a public policy course with her, Amanda Bartz and Nicole Sutterholm, who are in the audience as well from the same school.
Okay, very good. And Mr. Chair, could I make one comment? I know we're in a hurry, but I did look through what was going on, and it was interesting. I was looking on the website, and I saw Minnesota West Community Technical College in our system does offer a two-year guarantee tuition option, which I thought was interesting. So it is happening in a small way in our system already. So with that, if there's others that want to testify.
So, did I hear you correctly at the beginning? You are just informational today?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I think this is probably not ready for prime time, and it's definitely worth a discussion, and I think it's something we should be looking at in the future.
I think in the interest of time, since we're not taking any action, then I would like to maybe move on to the next bill. Would that be all right?
Okay.
Senator Gerlach?
If that's the case, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the time in presenting this issue and for you listening to this. It is something that we can do that can help give more greater access to students and help them keep them in school. I know that you're all interested in that, and I appreciate that. And we'll continue to pursue this in the Senate side as well, and you'll be hearing back from us on this with more details. And if there's any questions from any members, please contact myself or Representative Eastland, and we'll work with you on that.
Thank you very much. So we'll just lay over. That's about 3690. Okay, final bill 4032. Representative Erdahl, and you have some witnesses as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am ready for prime time.
Okay, you want to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 4032 for possible inclusion. I believe that's a motion you'd like, sure. Right? Okay. Also, I have, I guess I have an amendment. Maybe we should do that first here, too. Do you have the amendment?
I think the members all have the amendment.
Okay.
There's no, we need a number then?
We have to add one little word here.
Oh.
Association of American Publishers instead of the American Association of Publishers. Association of American Publishers.
Okay.
So I do that amendment.
Do we have that? That's just author's amendment?
Yep.
Okay. Do we call this an A1 amendment? Do we need to modify it in any way? That's this one? Can we let's do that for the
moment. Yeah, that's fine.
Call it A1.
Okay. A1. Okay.
All of those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendments adopted. Okay, go ahead, Senator Bordeaux.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we can do this fairly quickly. For many reasons, I'm concerned about the increase in the prices of college textbooks, as tuition has dramatically increased, we need to look at other costs faced by students as we also address their tuition increases. This bill proposes a task force to study pricing practices and to find out why textbook prices have been rapidly increasing. Basically, summing everything up, well, we just want to take a look at this through the Office of Higher Education to take a look in depth at what's going on with pricing.
Do you have a testifier who would like to say something?
Mr. Hal Kimball.
Mr. Kimball, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Hal Kimball. I am the chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association, and I'm a student at St. Cloud State University. I'd like to thank Representative Erdahl for helping us on this bill. First of all, I must say that my generation is a generation of debt. Many of the students that I advocate for are experiencing 20, 30, or more $1,000 in debt just by going to a public institution. So when we see our young couples who are now graduating college basically with a mortgage, a lot of that has to do with the exorbitant tuition increases that we've seen over the last several years. But a good portion of this also is due to the skyrocketing textbook prices that are, you know, equally as corrosive to our student pocketbooks. If you look at a government accounting office study from July 2005 titled "College Textbooks Enhanced Offerings Appear to Drive Recent Price Increases," you'll see part of this problem. On a nationwide perspective, if you look at how much our students at four-year colleges spend on textbooks, roughly about $898 per year, or on a nationwide level, about 26% of the tuition is spent on textbooks. At a state level, that's about 18% of that number. For our two-year schools, where a lot of our lower, socioeconomic students will attend, that number is $886, or about 75% of tuition on a nationwide level, or about 27% statewide. Our students, working with two-year faculty and four-year faculty, have met and we've discussed this issue at length, and we're kind of unified on this issue on many fronts. One story that I'd like to tell real briefly is a story of a professor at St. Cloud Technical College who teaches English composition, or writing composition. He's had textbooks in his classes for many years, obviously, and one book was this fourth edition of this this anthology of English writing. And he talks about how this fifth edition came out, and a lot of the writings that were in the fourth, he thought the fourth edition was the best book that he'd ever used in college. And this fifth edition came out, and it cut literally half the content that was in that book. And so his students were buying the fifth edition, then they're also having to buy Shakespeare and these other books to supplement that book. And so my question is, when does Shakespeare change? It's been hundreds of years since we've written many of these documents, and yet the industry continues to change these documents. An example of some of the textbooks that I have, this is a college algebra textbook. This is the fourth edition. The first edition of this was in 1996. This is the fourth edition this year, in 2006. So this textbook has changed four times in 10 years. College algebra has changed four times in the last 10 years. Another book that I have, this book was over $100. It's still in use today. This book is a intro to a business management book that I use at St. Cloud State University. This book cost me over $100. I tried to sell it back to a bookstore for $5. One of the issues that we see in the textbook industry is the CD-ROM that's inside this book. According to many of these studies, the CD-ROM drives the price of these textbooks anywhere from 30 to 40%. And one last example are my accounting books. A lot of times, and I bought these used, so they weren't necessarily bundled, but a lot of times the textbooks are bundled. So they'll have a nice cellophane wrap on them, they're brand new, and this book is bundled with this big book, our accounting book. This drives up, most of the time this book is never used in class, but yet you get both books for the price of one. So our students are seeing, you know, books that are bundled, CD-ROMs that are placed with the books, and unnecessary updates to many of these textbooks. So in closing, I would urge you to support this bill, which should be inclusive of all of our stakeholders here. We hope that this task force will have the ability through examining many of the practices that I've just described and we've discussed today can encourage better practices within the textbook industry and save our students who are already a generation of debt significant money.
Thank you. Question?
Chair, thank you for bringing the textbooks in. The algebra book or any of the books, how many chapters did you use from those books? Can you tell me?
Well,
did you use the whole book?
Mr. Kimball.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, we used the majority of the textbook or the chapters in this textbook. I used less than half of the chapters in this textbook and did not use the workbook. And in my business management book, we use probably about three-quarters of the chapters.
Mr. Kimball, what's on the CD-ROM that's attached to those books?
The CD-ROM has basically little small quizzes that are, you know, they're relatively easy. They don't really challenge. It's supposed to supplement the textbook.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's not very challenging.
But Mr. Chair, Mr. Kingle, it is not the text of the textbook. It's something in addition to the text of the textbook.
Mr. Chair,
the textbook does exist in a digital format. So the publisher could sell the student those selected chapters. In fact, you could. The way to do this would be to go to a website, pay for the selected chapters, download those chapters that you need, and not go through the hassle of all of this, the sixth edition in 5 years for a $100 textbook or whatever it is. But I mean, if this is the age of information, and this is already in digital format, the purpose of what this task force, I hope, does is bring back to us a proposal. And I'm going to use Winona State again. It's the only laptop university in the Minsky system that we should be able to download chapter by chapter. What you need, pay for it by chapter, and then use it. And we're not going to have the environmental impact of having all of this sitting here either, or you having to go back and say, I'm going to sell it back for a fraction of what you paid for. This is a good bill, and it's something that we really do need to do, not just to ease the student's cost, which I think is the number one priority here, but environmentally, and to focus our resources on what you're going to use for the class. This is a great bill, and I hope it brings back a report that's going to allow you to do that. Okay. Chapter by chapter, verse by verse.
Representative Bertal, I think you have two other testifiers, and we should call them both up here at the same time, in the interest of time. Okay. They're not your witnesses, I understand, but they're here anyway. Yeah. And we'd like to hear from you.
My name is
Chatted
today.
Yes. Okay. Please identify yourself.
Yeah.
Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bruce Hildebrand. I'm the executive director for the Association of American Publishers. I represent Reed Elsevier, among others. And I represent about 85% of the textbooks sold in American colleges and universities. And I just want to say we welcome the study. We want to address your question about what is now called iChapters, which are available for download. We want to address all of the new technologies that are coming online to help our increasingly weakened student body that we want to see them graduate on time. And we just will provide any resources we can to this committee, and we're already talking to the folks from higher education, and we look forward. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there Michael Goodwin? Welcome this afternoon, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives. I'm coming here to testify. First time I've been to any of these, so I'm going to try and follow a protocol. I'll be very brief if I can. Not only as a citizen, but as an industry expert with 32 years in the college textbook industry at various levels. I'm a member of the Tri-State Board of College Bookstores that serves both Minnesota colleges as well as the Dakotas, and a conference speaker at several state associations on the topic of textbook management. And so my concern was that we get all of the information out there for the committee to deal with. It's a very emotional issue. Comes from parents and students. Well, in fact, you know, I have to stipulate, textbook prices are too high. I myself put three kids through college, and my wife. And so I know, you know, how expensive these things are. This is looked at state levels all across the country. Currently, there have been a number of studies out recently from Harris, from the National Association of College Stores. GAO was referred to a little while ago, as well as California and some other studies. Rental systems is mentioned quite often. We're sitting right next to a state that has a number of rental systems, and so this rears its ugly head anyway quite frequently in the state of Minnesota, just because we're right next to Wisconsin. Illinois is another state that has a number of rental situations. What I'm concerned that we do here is that we address the analysis and the remedies and the solutions and get all of the points out. Yes, textbook prices are too high. Those studies pretty much all say that there isn't enough implementation or effective use of the textbook product. There are a number of different formats that have already been addressed in ways that can come out. And that's happening. That's going to be market-driven anyway. And so my concern was that would be sure and get that all the stakeholders get addressed here. One of the problems with the textbook market and the way that's handled in the educational environment is that there's a huge disconnect between the stakeholders. There's a conflicting agenda on an ongoing basis, perhaps a healthy but sometimes unhealthy tension between the agenda of administrators and faculty and students, and the college bookstores, of course, in the middle are trying to serve the needs of all of those things. Interestingly, we see quite a few articles in campus papers across the country that sort of vilifies the college bookstore. But what isn't said typically is that the college bookstore, in almost every situation, is giving their revenues directly over to the college, unless they're sitting across the street competing with that particular bookstore. So there's a lot of healthy competition there. The bookstore is a revenue source as well, but as I indicated, that revenue is going into the college as well to provide another source of revenue and not lining somebody else's pocket. So, again, my only interest, and I'll finish very quickly, is that, that we can contribute enough information to get a balanced analysis, informed solutions. I can speak for nearly every college manager in the 10 states and 3 provinces that I deal with, that they too are struggle daily to try and bring the price of textbooks down. And so I'll offer Representative Erdahl my name as well as a source to the National Association of College Stores, to the Tri-State College Store Association. By the way, I'm here as an individual, not officially representing that association, though that they know that I'm here. And so just trying to provide that information.
Thank you very much. Representative Carlson, you have a question?
Maybe the bill will be back before us, but the question I had, each of the bookstores is independent. Some are operated by the colleges, some are operated through a franchise kind of system. And the question I had, maybe they could say yes or no, would there be any advantage, and I'm not recommending that every course have the same textbook, there are different teaching styles and so on involved, but some do. Would there be any advantage of joint purchasing? Pulling of purchases, let's say, across the Minsky system, at least those professors that are recommending a given textbook.
Chairman and Representative, may I address that just briefly? Even on a single campus, that's addressed in various ways, where a psychology department at one campus perhaps will, for that intro psych course, all use the same. On the next campus, each teacher uses a different one. So it's problematic to date, as far as a practical matter, to do that even within the same college, beyond with a bunch of colleges. It's problematic, but it's worth looking at. We know that some of the problem identified in a number of these studies is centered in this disconnect that I spoke of. Getting timely title requisition information to the bookstore in time can drastically save the cost of the book for the student. The used book is a solution. When they can buy that book used, they save 25%, sell it back at the end of the term, they get half price. Now it's costing only $25 to use a $100 book. Now that doesn't happen on every book, but it happens on an average of plus or minus about half of the books. And so how that's done, there's a lot of ways to improve on this.
Thank you. We need to wrap. Representative Erdahl, would you like to renew your motion?
I will renew my motion.
House File 4032, passed and delayed over possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Very good. And with that, our meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.